Welcome. This is Real Estate Investing, live from New York with James Nelson, the principal and head of Avis & Young's Tri-State Investment Sales Group. In this program, you'll learn about the world of commercial real estate and find out why it is one of the largest investment opportunities in New York and around the world. Now, here is your host, James Nelson.
Welcome to show number 57 of Real Estate Investing, live from New York. This is your host, James Nelson. Thank you so much for joining us once again on the Voice America Network, and to all of you who are downloading this on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio.com, wherever you are getting your podcasts. I really, really appreciate your support and sharing this with your friends, your ratings, your comments. We're on a roll here. And the point of this show is to teach you how to invest in commercial real estate. But so much more than that, really, what it takes to build a business, what are the lessons learned to help you succeed in any market. And that's really the topic of this book that I've been working on, which is going to include some of the interviews from some of the legends in the business. So keep a lookout for that next year. We'll be really excited to roll that out. So for today's show, have a great interview for you with Stephen Kashanian and Adam Hedjabai from Closed Properties. That's Closed with a K. And this duo, well, it's their whole team. They're unbelievable. They are so active out in the market. They told me they've contracted on 14 properties since March. I don't think there's hardly any other buyers who can make that statement in New York. And they just do such a great job of staying front and center. And I certainly have benefited and, you know, try to run our brokerage team the same way, being front and center with the digital marketing. And really, I think for you investors out there who are already out looking to buy properties, getting your name out there and being top of mind when that broker has that great deal, I think that's really something for you to think about. So I think you're going to get a lot out of this interview. Stephen came to the U.S. in 2007 from Milan, having never done anything with real estate. He told me back in the day he was waiting tables, but wow, what an incredible business that he's built here. And Adam Hedjabai, who heads up his acquisitions, is going to teach you how to go out and source great deals out there. So we're going to take a brief word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Hi, I'm Mark Rose, Global CEO of Avis & Young, the world's fastest growing real estate services firm, and we are proud supporters of Voice America. With over 5,000 professionals in 120 offices in 20 countries, Avis & Young delivers local expertise in partnership with global reach. Because we are principally owned, Avis & Young prioritizes client success over shareholder profits. Through our open architecture, our firm's experts provide value-added, client-centric investment sales, leasing, advisory, management, and financing services to clients across the office, retail, industrial, multifamily, and hospitality sectors. Our culture is the bedrock for collaboration that enables each assignment to benefit from the collective intelligence garnered from a company-wide database. Partnership, performance. Learn how we deliver different at avisandyoung.com to learn more.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now it's time for our investor spotlight. And yes, with us is Stephen Kashanian and Adam Hedjabai of Closed Properties. So grateful to have you both here. Usually we just have one investor, but here we've got both of you, and wow, what an incredible team.
They're some of the most active deal makers in the city. We've had the pleasure of transacting with them over the years. And Stephen and I have also had the pleasure, you know, while out in Vegas at ICSE, having a little fun out on the racetrack, driving some cars. So great to see you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Perfect. So, Stephen, maybe you can give us a little history on Closed Properties. Tell us, when did you start this? What was the impetus? And then maybe tell us a little bit more about what the company does.
So I moved from Italy in 2002 for college. Out of college, I started working with my grandfather. At the time, he was buying foreclosure homes in the boroughs. I worked with him a couple of years. I didn't really love it. I went on my own in 2007. I opened up Closed Properties, and I started as a brokerage. I had a couple of high net worth friends and family that I knew. I knew were active in the real estate business, so I was focusing on finding them opportunities until in 2013, I found a retail condo in Manhattan. And I went to my top buyer at the time. I'm like, listen, if you want the property, I'm coming in as a partner. I'm not selling you the asset. Thank God we did very, very well with that asset. We found a tenant, we refinanced it. With that money, we bought a second building, and it just snowballed from there. Today, thank God, we are vertically integrated. We have a strong acquisition team. We have an asset management firm in-house. We do a construction management in-house, and we take care of the deals from soup to nuts, all within the infrastructure. We've built a niche and an expertise for hairy and complicated assets, sub $10 million. We are driven primarily by volume. And because of the expertise that we built through the years of handling these more complicated situations, maybe assets that have significant amount of violations, structural problems, tenancy issues, we reposition them and then put them into a portfolio.
Fantastic. And I definitely am excited to get into the details, and you really have built a machine. And I love how I always get those weekly email updates from you all. You're in contract on 12 properties. You've closed, you know, another 20 to date. And you guys are just an incredible volume shop. And I think an inspiration to a lot of people looking to get into this. So, you know, Stephen, how did you originally, I guess, pick brokerage? I guess you said your family had some experience with it, but did you know when you went to college and came to the U.S. that real estate was in your future?
No, absolutely not. I actually interviewed over a summer for a small broker at the time, and I got my feet wet into the business. I fell in love with the transactional nature of it. Very quickly I realized that this is something I wanted to devote my life and career to. I didn't really have any backing or any real capital, so the easier way of getting into the business and making some money was through the brokerage angle. I really spent the first 3-4 years focusing primarily on 4 buyers that I had who gave me their wish list, and I would scout the market, find them opportunities, and get paid by them.
So, Adam, did you start your career as a broker, or how did you get into the business?
So I actually started by, I was in the jewelry business, and I knew Stephen at the time, and the jewelry business wasn't really, you know, my cup of tea. So I asked Stephen, you know, while I was in my senior year of college, asked him, you know, if there's any opportunities and for me to work with him. And he actually told me, yeah, there's a management position, you know, as an intern position, and, you know, you get great experience. So I actually started, I got my feet wet in the business by doing management and leasing for clothes. And that kind of trickled into getting more involved in the acquisition side, which I've been doing for the past 3 or 4 years. So that's how I got started.
You know, imagine that's fantastic experience for ownership to kind of get a feel for the management, but also for the leasing to be on the front line, because I've got to figure when you're underwriting properties today, you know, you've been out there before, you know, trying to rent this space, trying to run it, and you know what it really takes to run a property. I think, you know, it's great advice to our listeners because, you know, as much as we try to put reliable information on a broker's flyer, you know, these are most of the time projections and you really have to vet it and you really have to know what's out there. I mean, especially with retail today, I mean, with everything going on in the world, to understand if you've got vacant retail, you know, how are you going to pro forma that rent? How long is it going to take you to get that tenant in there? What type of concessions you're going to have to pay? So I think that's really a tremendous experience. So Stephen, you said when you made the transition from broker to principal, so it was, you know, you found a great deal, another deal to another deal. I mean, at what point did you start to wind down the brokerage, or do you still do a little brokerage on the side?
After our second acquisition, I said to myself, let's just focus and devote ourselves solely to the acquisition side and build an infrastructure that would allow us to reposition these assets. So in reality, we haven't been brokering deals since. And our focus, as I was saying, has been primarily sourcing more opportunities and building an infrastructure that allows us to reposition these problematic assets. You know, one thing that I bring up very often during our team meetings to my team is, you know, I can give you the keys to the Empire State Building for free. I'll give you the asset for free. But if you don't know what you're doing with the asset, within a week you're under. So we've been investing a significant amount of resources and time and energy to rebuild a very strong infrastructure. And today we have over 30 people working within Closed and Blue Sky Group, which is our asset management arm.
Yeah, I mean, you really have to build teams and systems, and that is such a reoccurring theme as I talk to, you know, some of the other legends in the business and talking about how they were able to scale, and it's about having those systems in place and being able to scale and the right people. So no doubt, based on your track record and your success, you've got the right people on board and the right systems. So Stephen, I would love to hear if you can share a little bit more about that first deal, because a lot of the listeners to the show, you know, maybe they're a real estate broker, maybe they're an architect, they're looking to take the plunge, they're looking to do the first deal. So you found a great opportunity. So it starts with a great deal. So I don't know if you sourced that off market or what made it such a great deal, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. And then when you brought it to one of your clients and you proposed to be partners, how did that work? Were each of you going to put in half the money, or, you know, how did that work, and how were you going to divide up the winnings?
So that was a turning point in my career. I found this deal that is being marketed by Massinaco, Michael DeChesser, an old friend of yours. It was a
really good friend. Hopefully he's listening. If not, I'll tell him he has to.
Great guy. It was a vacant bar at 302 Broome Street, fully built out bar, 2000 at grade, 2000 below level. They used to be called the Happy Ending. So the seller was the operator of the bar. He had some family issues. He wanted to move to Florida. He was asking over $3 million. At the time, I thought that the value was there, you know, to have a fully built out bar in a good location. You should be able to bring in a certain amount of rent. And when I saw the space, I fell in love with it. And we negotiated.
This was a real hot spot too. I mean, I guess that the name was kind of, you know, a little, you know, tongue in cheek, but like this was a legitimate lounge. I mean, this was kind of like one of the hot spots downtown. Surprised that he would just pack up his bags and leave. But I guess your opportunity to take over.
We got very lucky. We bought the asset for $1.8 million. I was projecting $15,000 a month in rent. And the reality is that when you're doing your first deals, you really cannot afford to make any mistakes whatsoever. So I remember in one day, I showed the space to 7 different leasing brokers at an hour interval, because I couldn't rely on one opinion and make such a mistake, especially on my first acquisition. So I really had to cross all my T's and dot my I's to make sure that we're on point. We were underwriting at $15,000 a month. It was a projected 7 cap. We got really lucky. We ended up renting the space for $20,000. turned the asset into close to a 9.5 cap. We refinanced it very quickly, and that really gave me the confidence, but also the liquidity to roll my money to a second deal. We still own 302 Broome Street today, but that was one of the key moments in my career that really allowed me to make the transition into ownership. And you asked me about how I structured my first acquisition. It was very simple. I went to my client. I'm like, this is the property. This is the rent that I think we're going to be able to get. I want to get my commission and roll it in. So I came into the ownership, overall ownership, for 5%. I couldn't afford to buy in more equity at the time. So, and that for me at the time was a very big nut. So I started with a 5% position in that retail condo. I ran everything from soup to nuts, the leasing, the negotiations, the work that we're supposed to do for the tenant, the relationship with the tenant throughout. I worked on the refi. So my partner got a lot of bang for his buck. And that was an amazing opportunity for me to finally make a lifetime transition.
Wow. That, you know, for everyone listening, I mean, to get into this deal, and that's what you call sweat equity, right? So if you don't have the money to put into a deal, you add value. You brought an incredible opportunity. You know, you brokered it. You used the credit from that as your contribution. And, you know, what you got out of that deal, I'm sure, was so much more than the economics. It was the experience. And like you said, I mean, that was really kind of the starting point where once you were able to refinance out and get some real equity, then you could you know, roll that into your future. So you stuck with with retail for a while. And, you know, Adam, maybe you could speak a little bit about, you know, not only retail, but also multifamily, because I know, having spoken to you all, you know, over the last year or two, you've really... I don't want to say pivoted, but you're very focused now in the boroughs. You're doing a lot of volume with some of these smaller multis. But, you know, how long, you know, originally it really seemed your firm was very retail focused. And now I would say you're really more multifamily focused. So I'm sure you all think about kind of what your focus is. And was that kind of the transition and the history of, you know, the firm starting retail and now multi? Is that fair to say?
Yeah. We originally started out buying, you know, net lease deals, strip centers, shopping centers out of New York State. And then we trickled down into buying retail condos in good parts of Manhattan, you know, in the East Village and downtown and the financial district. And then as retail was kind of getting kind of shaky, the market, we started shifting our focus more so into multifamily, you know, in good neighborhoods in Brooklyn. Over the past few years, we've been, you know, deploying a lot of capital in the Bronx and Upper Manhattan. We just bought a few more buildings in Queens. So I would say we are still tackling retail, you know, especially in the boroughs, but we've shifted our focus, you know, more so to multifamily mixed use assets in good pockets of the boroughs over the past, I would say, 24 to 36 months.
Perfect. So Adam, I think it'd be super helpful for everyone to hear how you all source opportunities, because, I mean, as Steven said, it started with a deal, right? So I got to imagine that you all have an enormous pipeline, right? So because it's not like you're buying every deal you see. I mean, can you give us a sense, first of all, how do you go find the opportunities? How big is your pipeline at any given point? And then how many of those initial properties of interest end up to closed properties?
So that's a great question. So
Alex, don't give them too much of our secret sauce, please.
So honestly, the bulk of our majority of our business is just relationship driven. You know, whether it's people that we've spoken to, been in touch over the past few years, whether it's meeting them in their offices for coffee or, you know, through email, through our email campaigns, you know, large chunk of our deals have been through broker relationships, people that we've been in touch with. And it's not always the first time that we get them, that we hit the deal on the first shot. There's always this concept, which I'm sure you can attest to, is always following up. We're always engaging in deals that we like the location, the price isn't too bad, you know, if we own something in the area. So I mean, our network of brokers and relationships, it's majority relationship driven. You know, we take pride in, you know, how we communicate with our network, our honesty, our transparency. And I think, you know, our brokers and clients, you know, appreciate that. So they, and they, at the end of the day, after you've shown the market that you've transacted, you're active and you're seriously buying, then people trust you more.
I know that, and if I'm not mistaken, Adam, you focus on the off-market opportunities and speaking also directly with owners. And then Jacob Namdar heads up more of the broker relations. Is that right?
So Jacob and I actually work as a team. We're dealing all day on the market. We do have one guy in our office that does direct canvas owners in Upper Manhattan and the Bronx, and one guy in our office that does direct canvas to owners in Brooklyn. And we have a system in place, you know, that it kind of prevents overlapping on, you know, deals. So we have a structure in place, but Jacob and I work as a team that we deal with brokers and deals on the market all day.
So Adam or Steven, you know, I'd love to hear about your outreach to brokers, because look, I'm a broker. My job is, you know, reaching out, making calls. I've called both of you a bunch of times, you know, hey, I've got an opportunity. Take a look at this. I mean, that's, you know, what we do as brokers. We, you know, we've got a job to go sell properties to, you know, stay with constant outreach. I just to make the observation, there's very few buyers who are actually calling me on a routine basis. And you all are one of the exceptions to that. Not only are you reaching out to brokers on a regular basis, but you have a very consistent marketing outreach. Because look, every single time you send out a release saying, hey, we just bought another property, and I don't know how big your list is, and Steven, you don't have to give away all your trade secrets, but I gotta imagine I'm not the only broker getting that email. You know, it's saying, you know, closed properties is open for business. You're transacting. If you got an opportunity, call us. And so, you know, I think that's really effective. So, you know, Adam or Steven, is it kind of a conscientious thing where you're reaching out to brokers on a regular basis? And if so, what are you talking to them about? And how do those conversations go?
Being a small firm and being that New York especially is extremely competitive, very early in the game, we had to make a determination on how are we going to differentiate ourselves from the bigger boys. And we made some strategic decisions. One of them was picking a specific segment as far as dollar size. Another one was picking up a specific type of assets, the more complicated ones. But also as far as our marketing and our message. At the end of the day, a broker that is marketing an asset really cares, I think, about two things. A is working with people they can trust, because at the end of the day, they have a limited amount of time and effort they can allocate to a specific asset. So building that rapport and trust, it's very, very critical. And the second, to deal with a buyer that actually pulls the trigger and shows up at the closing table and signs the check. So our marketing effort is catered to this. I know that we are more on the aggressive side, but it's done by design, because we want to reinforce and reassure people that we, even in the middle of a pandemic, for example, since April, we signed 13 different acquisitions. Now, these were smaller acquisitions, but the total aggregate value is over $30 million. The point I'm trying to make is that in any market, there are opportunities, and we want to make sure that the brokerage community, the lenders and the partners understand what we're buying, how we're buying, where we're buying, so they were in constant contact. And the more they see the volume of deals that we're closing, the more our credibility as buyer grows, because you cannot fake a closing. You cannot fake a post. At the end of the day, you have to close on an asset in order to be able to advertise it.
You know, everything you're saying makes so much sense. And just to keep those lines of communication open, and it's not just the brokers, but the lenders and that whole network. But I'm also still, and hopefully our audience realizes. So you said since March or year to date, how many transactions have you closed and how many do you have in contract? What was the number again?
So since April alone, since COVID hit, we signed 14 separate acquisitions, out of which we closed on 9 already.
Yeah.
Since April.
I don't think that there's one buyer in New York City who can say that they've signed more contracts than you have since April. I mean, it's again, I mean, some investors are doing, you know, larger transactions in one shot, but you know, that volume, because I've got to imagine, you know, even to do a $2 or $3 million deal is probably as much work as a $30 million deal. You still have to go in and do the diligence and make sure the leases check out and all that. So, I mean, it's a real compliment to what you're doing. But, I mean, I got to ask, I mean, these are really scary times. A lot of investors, you know, have been sitting on the sidelines. You know, maybe they're waiting because they figure that pricing is going to drop further. I mean, what gave you the confidence to jump in and do, you know, sign 14 contracts since April?
I believe from my very core that all the years before COVID, all the negotiations, all the underwriting, all the deals that we lost, all the mistakes that we made were to prepare us for this. This doesn't mean that I am delusional and I don't understand the risks and the problems that we're facing. But at the end of the day, real estate is a long-term game. And the way I look at it is that in phases, right? There is probably going to be a lot of pain in the short to midterm. Midterm to long-term, I'm still a strong believer in New York, regardless of the politics of it. We are becoming more and more of a tech hub. And these are thousands of people being employed in New York with high-paying jobs. And there is a lot going in our advantage, I believe, in the long term. The short term is going to be very, very painful. But I think about it all the time, right? I have a lot of my grandfather's friends, men that are in their 70s, 80s. They walk in Manhattan. They're like, Steven, you see this 100,000 square foot building? I could have bought it for $2 million in the 70s. Now, it's not as dramatic now as it was then, but I think that it's a good comparison because ultimately the types of assets that we're buying right now are significantly better located than the types of assets we're buying 3 years ago. We just signed a hard contract on an amazing mixed-use piece on Bedford Avenue where they were asking $11 million pre-COVID. When you're buying at more than 50% discount, in a prime location, yes, there's going to be pain, but eventually the world will turn around and wake up and, you know, things will go back. So as long, it's very important for the people that are listening to us that whenever you're making an acquisition, you want to make sure that you're 120% transparent with your partners and your lenders with what the threats are, what the problems are. If you have a solution for your problems, that's going to help you take the deal to the finishing line. And you have to make sure that you're aligned as far as expectations, right? To go to a lender and tell them you're going to take them out on a loan that you're closing out in 6 months, it's not very likely. So as long as you're going in at a low base, we really make our money on the buy. And as long as our acquisition base is low, thank God we have the wherewithal of repositioning the kind of assets. We have incredible banking relationships, and we have very, very loyal partners that have been with us for a long time that, thank God, have the capability of withstanding, you know, for a while till things start turning around.
No doubt there's tremendous opportunities now, but you got to take that long-term view. So when you go to your investors today, do you tell them, look, the business plan is, you know, a typical business plan would be 5 to 7 years, reposition it, then resell, refinance. I mean, what are you telling your investors today?
Every time I share an acquisition with my partners, I start with the laundry list of problems. And we tend to overemphasize on the problems so that we can set the expectations correctly. If there is a potent, if there is a 10% likelihood of a bad event happening, we share with them very, very clearly so that there is no misunderstanding. But also through time, through experience, there are very few problems that cannot be resolved. So for every problem, there is a solution. And this is really what we do. We're a solution-driven firm. We're as flexible and creative as they come. And thank God our partners have been very loyal to us, and they give us the bandwidth to do what we do. And the fact that we are running all the asset management and all the construction in-house gives us a tremendous advantage, because we're able to run projects faster, cheaper than other people. And time is money in our business.
You said so many good things there. Just writing it down. I mean, it really... the transparency. Look, there's issues. There's always problems, and I've always been a huge proponent, especially when we're, you know, selling properties. Tell everyone the good, the bad, the ugly up front, right? Because they're likely going to find out anyways, and you'd rather just, you know, get over that. That, you know, if there's a roadblock, and look, it might not be for all investors, right? But they know what they're getting into. And, you know, that's how you do repeat business, because when things come up, it's not a surprise. So that's really helpful. Adam, you know, talking to sellers today, the brokers in this new environment, you know, I got to imagine it's been a little easier to transact. I mean, when you're in a really hot market where prices have been going up, you know, you find yourself, I'm sure, getting into a lot of bidding wars, sellers who say, you know, you think you have a deal, and then they raise their price again. You know, do you really feel more like it's a buyer's market now?
I do believe it's more of a buyer's market right now rather than a seller's market. I always tell this to the brokers and whoever I speak to. I said, right now, as opposed to how it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, if a seller wants the market is building, he really has to have a real reason or motivation behind that. You know, if he has to have a story, you know, for example, for the deals that, you know, we've signed since COVID, each one of those properties or deals had a certain motivation or story behind it, whether it's partnership dispute or long-term ownership that just wants to move to out of state or whatever it may be. Every seller right now has to have a motivation or a story behind it to meet the market. In terms of, is it easier right now? I mean, I think there's less competition out there, as I'm sure you can attest to it. I mean, a lot of buyers are just on the sidelines right now. So in terms of, you know, getting into competitive bidding wars, it's not as much as it was used to be, but it's still very tough right now, just because every deal just has its layers of issues, you know, taking the deal from the beginning to the finishing line. So it is a buyer's market, I believe, but I still think there's still that gap between, you know, sellers' expectations and, you know, what makes sense for the buyers. But as Stephen mentioned, I think things will turn around and we'll be able to bridge the gap even further.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the seller's motivation. I mean, you'd be surprised how rarely an investor asks me, James, why is this person selling? You know, and it's, you know, for me, it's the number one question is, you know, what is the seller's motivation? Why are they looking to do something? And, you know, look, in a hot market, it might be, you know, hey, if they can get a certain price, then why not? You know, but today, to your point, someone who's selling into this has to have a real reason, whether they're taking chips off the table, whether they're trying to put, you know, fires out elsewhere, you know, or, you know, maybe they're selling a smaller asset and sure they're going to sell at a lower price than they would have a year ago. But when they go to buy something larger, they'll get, you know, and even a bigger discount. So, but I think it's always helpful to know, you know, what is the seller's situation, because that can also help you, you know, answer any of the challenges or hesitations they have. And I really like what Stephen had to say about being, you know, solutions oriented. So, I'd love to spend a little bit of time just on how you built up your organization. So, Stephen, you started as a small brokerage shop. Now you got 30 people. You're fully integrated. You know, I'm sure when you started out, I don't. Maybe you'll tell me that you were still doing everything in house, managing, leasing, you know, construction. But what was kind of, you know, I'm sure at some point you were at a crossroads where you either had to, you know, massively scale up your operation or outsource more to the third party. So what prompted you to grow out your operation and become vertically integrated? And what does that really mean? What do you all do from start to finish?
It was a slow transition. I believe in doing things gradually and building strong foundations. So Adam alluded to this earlier. I just wanted to pinpoint that we started with retail at first because it was the easiest asset class to manage. If you're buying a triple net McDonald's in Wyoming, there is really not much to do. If you're buying a retail condo in Manhattan, once it's occupied, you put it away. So as we've gotten more confidence and more knowledge and more capital, we started getting into more complicated assets. We started getting more involved with construction. But I knew from the very beginning that it makes a tremendous difference whenever you are managing your own portfolio. Because I will spend $75 replacing a sink that the manager that is on a salary would probably spend $150, $200. Now, this is not a lot of money, but if it happens 2,000 or 3,000 times a year, it can turn into a lot of money. So we've put in a significant emphasis in building an infrastructure as we're growing. Today, we have six people running in the acquisitions department. We have over 20 people in management. Anything from bookkeeping, collections, legal, payables, receivables, tenant relations, maintenance. Then it opens up to the supers, and then under them you have the porters. So it's a very, very tight organization with very defined job descriptions and roles and responsibilities. And this is something that early on, a lot of it was falling onto me. But as we grew the portfolio, we had to bring in the right people to help us grow organically. I'll tell you, asset management is a money pit. This is something that if you're doing it correctly, you're doing it properly. The second you're scaling up a little bit, you're going to need more people to help you manage. But ultimately, when you're preserving tens of millions of dollars of valuations on a portfolio, it's probably one of the best investments you can make. Now, regarding the construction, we soon realized we're doing a significant amount of volume on renovations. And what we're doing, we're hiring contractors. They were charging us an arm and a leg and doing a crappy job. So we started working closer with subs. I brought in a couple of people whose sole job is running our construction. And today alone, we have five different projects, different buildings, different boroughs. Some are as small as three apartments. And the bigger one right now, it's a three family that we're turning into a 12 family in Belmont and anything in between. So I'm a firm believer in building a strong infrastructure, have the right people in place, because that's what's going to allow you really to grow organically. Because if you're making a mistake, that mistake can end up costing you significantly more.
You know, I really appreciate your sharing that. And, you know, it's easier said than done. And for our listeners who, you know, maybe they've got a partner, maybe they've got a couple properties under their belt and they're at a crossroads and saying, hey, are we going to really scale this thing and do volume or not? But, you know, I got to imagine with 30 people, 30 salaries, I mean, that's a lot of cost. And so, you know, as you grow, and you said you grew very carefully, but I've got to assume that whatever, you know, asset management fees that you have or acquisition fees, is that what's fueling the salaries? Because again, for those listening who don't, you know, who have a partnership, they haven't hired anyone like maybe a full-time acquisitions person, you know, at what point do you feel confident enough about the money that the company's bringing in to start committing to those salaries?
Listen, this is a very delicate point. The growing pains that we went through, I don't wish it through my worst enemy, because as you said, whenever you have to make a decision on bringing in more people and having more responsibilities and mouths to feed, it's a very serious responsibility. Ultimately, though, I made a determination that this is my life career, God willing, unless something happens. And if you want to build a career in this field, touching complicated assets, you have no choice but to align yourself with people that have your same vision, mentality, tolerance to pain, and desire to grow and do good things. But it's not easy. It's really not easy. The management fees that we bring in, they are not enough to cover all the overhead. And the way that I'm able to sustain it is because of the value that we create overall within the portfolio. Thank God, I know we're over 95% on our collections, which in New York on smaller buildings is really, really good. But that didn't just happen. This is because we have the right people in place, we have the right structure and processes. Right when COVID hit, immediately we reached out to our tenants in a very human, proper way, let them know that we're there for them if they needed any kind of assistance. So we really try to do the right thing by our tenants, by our people. And I really believe that in the long run, it pays up tremendously more.
I really appreciate your sharing that and the openness, because I know that's going to be super helpful for our listeners as they think about investing in their business and their team. And I feel exactly the same way as you do, that it's really about the people in this business. And if we were just on our own individually, we could only accomplish a fraction of what we do. So Adam, maybe you could talk a little bit about, what attracted you to Close Properties, and, you got 30 people there. What is the synergy like? Because it's such a big piece of your success. So, how are you interacting with people throughout the day? What's it like?
I mean, we have a nice crowd in our office. I'm primarily engaging more so with the acquisitions guys, just, going over deals, making sure, our underwriting is on point. We all kind of cross-check each other to make sure, if I'm underwriting this deal, make sure you have another pair of eyes to make sure I'm not missing anything, and I look at someone else's deal just to kind of, collaborate and work more so as a team. But we have a great, great crew, hardworking guys. We have a good camaraderie and we work more so as a team. And I think it's really important since, a lot of people, they work part of companies with a bunch of people, and it's very key. It's a huge key to work, collectively as a team, because it just makes, it benefits the entire company and makes you grow even more. So, the camaraderie and helping each other out is what we take our pride in as well.
Wonderful. This has been such an incredible conversation, and really, again, no surprise how successful you've been, throughout this. And, Stephen, with only a couple minutes left, would love to hear what your advice would be to an aspiring investor, someone who's maybe thinking about getting into the business, maybe they're a little nervous about with everything going on and when to jump in. What would your advice be to them?
I think that fear is healthy. It's a good thing because it keeps you in check. I think that especially the first transactions are really going to shape your career, because if your first acquisitions are successful, they build your confidence. They help you understand better the life cycle of a deal. It helps your reputation with lenders and with partners. So I would cherry pick the first acquisitions very, 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 very carefully. And as you grow, you make more acquisitions. It's really critical to have an infrastructure behind you that allows you to keep growing. I am very, very proud of my team. We have a very open dialogue. We don't have an employer and employee kind of relationship. We all work as a team. And when you're leading a company, it's critical to really lead by example. I happen to be a maniac when it comes to work. So I'm in the office by 6:15 in the morning, and I don't leave till much later. But that's A, because I love what I do. I'm fortunate enough that my family, my wife and kids are very supportive of it. But I wouldn't be able to tell my guys to work hard if I was sipping tequila on the beach all day. So if you're running a business, it's critical to really lead by example. Don't forget that people don't really forget when you do something wrong. They may nod, they may pretend, but doing the right thing, even if it's painful and difficult, long-term pays dramatically. Now, we are dealing with a lot of money, and money, unfortunately, brings the worst in people. I give this example to my acquisition guys on a daily basis. I'm like, listen, you're here talking millions of dollars all day long, but put me $20,000 on the table right now. How fast can you get $20,000? It's a lot of money. We get desensitized by the money aspect because we treat them as if they were potato chips. So dealing with people with integrity, surrounding yourself with people that you can trust, that you can rely on, it's very, very, very important. And that's ultimately how you're going to be able to build a real relationship with your investors and with your lenders and with your team. It's a lot of work, but ultimately I believe that this is the best way of growing and scaling.
Well, Stephen, you definitely are a power of example, and Adam, I'm sure you would agree. And it's amazing to hear what both of you and your company has achieved. So just really appreciate your coming on the show today and sharing your story. I know our listeners are going to get a tremendous amount out of it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you again. So this is your host, James Nelson of Real Estate Investing, live from New York.
A different approach to putting our clients first. Avis & Young's Tri-State Investment Sales Group sells multifamily, office, retail, development, and specialty sales throughout the New York metro area. As experienced thought leaders in their industry, our 35-member group is available to help you make informed investment decisions by advising you on your current holdings or identifying new opportunities in the marketplace. Our one unified team is built on an industry-unique platform which promotes unparalleled collaboration and teamwork. We share core values of hard work, integrity, and expertise. We put our clients first, providing tailor-made strategies to achieve superior results. Please visit us at aytristateinvestmentsales.com and follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram at JamesNelsonNYC to learn more.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Real Estate Investing, live from New York. Please join your host, James Nelson, for another program next Tuesday at 7 p.m. in New York, 4 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. All shows are rebroadcast Wednesday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time, as well as always on demand. We'll talk again next week. We'll be right back.